Imposter syndrome is really just a wounded little kid who thinks that they're running a grown adult's life. My name is Andrea, and this is Adult Child. Welcome back to Adult Child, where we take a deep dive into the impact of growing up in a dysfunctional family. Ahoy, my dear shitshows. For any new listeners, my name is Andrea. I am a total and complete shitshow, and I am an adult child of a dysfunctional family. And if you're wondering, what the hell is an adult child? Well, allow me to tell you. So an adult child is somebody whose unresolved childhood pain surfaces and plays out in adulthood, and not in a good way, okay? We're talking people-pleasing, approval-seeking, fear of authority figures, an inability to say no, an inability to stand up for yourself, hypervigilance, so constantly bracing for impact, always waiting for the other shoe to drop, a deep fear of abandonment, staying in toxic, unhealthy relationships way past their due date, a deep fear of criticism, even constructive criticism. Compliments make you uncomfortable. A fear of angry people, addiction, any and all forms, or a tendency to find yourself in relationships with people who have addiction issues, an addiction to negative excitement, an inability to feel your feelings, or the inability to feel certain feelings. And when you talk about your childhood, you sound like you are a news reporter standing in front of a burning house, except that house is actually your house burning down. So if you related to a few of those, and I'm sure you did, okay, you didn't land here by mistake, you probably are an adult child. So welcome aboard this hot mess of a ship. We curse here, you've been warned. So today, folks, we're diving deep into something that seems to deeply, deeply resonate with us all. And that is a little old thing called imposter syndrome. And you're actually getting another solo episode with me today. And I just want to say that part of me doing this episode is me confronting my own imposter syndrome, but I will share more on that later. So as I said, this is something that seems to strike a chord with us all. Whenever this is a topic for one of the Shit Show support group meetings, I never have to worry about whether or not people are going to raise their hands. And today we are going to be taking a look at this with a depth that I personally have not heard anywhere else, like truly through the lens of complex PTSD. You know, when you Google imposter syndrome, you'll find articles that are, you know, that talk about like, this is what trauma-based imposter syndrome is. And the truth is that like all imposter syndrome is trauma-based, okay? It's all related to some sort of childhood conditioning or experience. But I do think though, that for us shit shows, that those of us who, you know, have complex PTSD, those of us whose childhoods are really wreaking havoc on our lives as adults, we're dealing with a different animal here. And so that's what we're going to be exploring today. So let's get on with the damn show, shall we? But first, let's talk about what you, yes, you, yes, you need to damn the Join Shit Show. This is my online support community where we have a minimum of 6 weekly Zoom support groups where you can connect with other fellow shit shows who are doing the damn work to heal. This is a support system at your fingertips in your back pocket that you can access on the web or on your phone. And this is where people are doing the work, okay? Like we're really doing the work, but we also have some fun and we also have a sense of humor in this community, okay? So this is hard work, okay? This ain't fun. Who are we kidding? I'm not going to try to sell you this as this healing work is fun. It is rough, okay? It is brutal. But I'm telling you that if you want to make this a little bit more tolerable, and if you want to be amongst others who are going to make you feel seen, heard, and understood in a way in which you've never experienced before, then hop aboard this damn ship already, okay? So you, yes, you, yes, you, the person that's been wanting to join for forever, how about we change that today, okay? For less than a damn dollar a day, you can quit after a month. So head to adultchildpodcast.com/shitshow, or you can see the link in the show notes next. Give me a follow on Insta, on TikTok, at adultchildpod. And last but not least, and I mean it, please, please, please give me a damn 5-star rating on Apple, on Spotify. Thank you. Love you all. All right, folks. So let's start with where this term imposter syndrome comes from, because I personally was not familiar with the backstory, and I'm assuming that's probably the case for many of y'all too. So this comes from a paper that was published in 1978 called The Imposter Phenomenon in High Achieving Women. And it was written by two psychologists, Pauline Clance and Suzanne Imes, who were working together at Oberlin College, which is in Ohio. And so this was something that Pauline had lived with, but just didn't have a name for it at the time. When she was in grad school, she was convinced that she had just fooled her way in. And she was just living in this perpetual state of just waiting for somebody to figure out that she didn't actually belong there. And so fast forward to when she's doing counseling at Oberlin and she's working with these women students, and she starts hearing the exact same thing coming out of their mouths. And these were women who were objectively crushing it. They were the top of their class. They were getting incredible grades, and they were sitting across from her saying that, you know, admissions must have made a mistake, that like they got into this school by accident. And they weren't just saying that they felt insecure. They were saying that they weren't actually smart, that they had pulled one over somebody, and that they were living with this constant low-grade dread of the day that somebody would finally figure it out, the day that somebody would finally figure them out. And so this is where the paper came from. So over 5 years, they worked with more than 150 highly successful women, and every one of them had the degrees, had the scholastic honors, the high test scores, the praise, the professional recognition and respect, and not one single one had any sort of internal sense of success. They considered themselves imposters. And so that's where this term imposter phenomenon comes from, which they defined as this internal experience of intellectual phoniness. And they identified two separate family patterns, family dynamics that resulted in this. And so the first one was somebody had a sibling or a cousin or, you know, some close relative who got assigned as the smart one, but they were assigned as the sensitive one. And being the sensitive one meant something different back in 1978. So now when we say like you're the sensitive one, we usually mean it in a negative connotation, right? You're too emotional, you're too much. Back then, sensitive was paired directly with being socially adept. So it meant that you were the perceptive one, the charming one, the one that was good with people. So it was meant as a compliment at that time. And so underneath this message of like, you're the sensitive one, was that, you know, she will never be able to prove that she's as smart as her sibling, no matter what she actually accomplishes. And there's a part of her that truly believes this. And there's a part of her that wants to prove this wrong. And so school becomes the place where she tries to do so. And so she does. She gets the good grades. She gets the honors. You know, the teachers love her and she brings it home to the family. But the family doesn't budge on the identity that has been assigned to her. Like the other sibling is still the smart one, even if she has higher grades than the smart one. And so then two things happen from this. Like she's still chasing the validation of trying to be the smart one to prove that she's just as smart as her sibling. But at the same time, she's also starting to think that maybe her parents are right. And she starts to look at her own grades and decides that, you know, she must have gotten these good grades by being good at reading her teacher, by being charming. They refer to it in the paper as intellectual flattery. So basically, she'd figure out what a professor believed and then load her paper with studies that backed that, even if she personally disagreed with that. And here's the trap. Because she never actually says what she actually thinks, she's just giving the answer that she thinks that the teacher wants instead of what she actually believes. She never gets to figure out like whether her own thinking would have held up. She just carries around this belief that if they actually knew what I thought, they'd know that I'm not smart. And then the second pattern that they identified was essentially the kid who got deemed the smart one, but like sort of to the extreme. You know, it was basically the kid that was told that she was the best at everything. It was like the family conveyed to her that she was superior in every way, that she wasn't just smart, but she is perfect and she is superior at everything with ease. It just comes to her naturally. And so then she starts running into things that she struggles with because she's a kid, right? Because that's what being a person is. And this is where it all starts to come apart because she's being praised for everything indiscriminately all the time, which means the praise stops meaning anything. Like she starts to distrust her parents' read on her entirely. If they're telling her that she's perfect at things she knows that she's not perfect at, then how would she know when they're right? And once she can't trust their read on her, she can't trust her own either. Like she just starts to completely doubt herself. So then she gets to college and it gets worse because she does do outstanding work, but she has to study to do it. And she's internalized her parents' definition of what smart means, and smart means perfection with ease. Like that's the whole standard. So the fact that she has to work at it means that she's not smart. She's not a genius. So she must be dumb. She must just be faking it. And that's the bind that she can't get out of because now every good grade proves nothing and every bit of effort proves everything. It's not that she's smart. It's either that she just got lucky or that she just put in more time and effort than everyone else. And the paper gives two examples of what this looked like in a kid. So there was one who faked being sick 3 Fridays in a row to get out of a spelling bee because she couldn't stand the idea of her parents finding out that she wouldn't win. And then there was another one, another kid where she, you know, was hiding the fact that she was studying. Like she'd pretend to be, she'd pretend to be playing with her art supplies every time that her mom came into her room because her mother had told her that smart people don't have to study. So again, this came out in 1978, and it was specifically about high achieving women who didn't believe they were smart. Like that's the frame. But now I want to give you my perception of this, you know, sitting here now in 2026, circling back to the first pattern. So this is the one who got deemed the sensitive one, the socially adept one, the one that her parents never viewed as being the smart one. And no matter what she does, their opinion never changes. So she never changes her opinion about herself. And I think this speaks to how imposter syndrome shows up for us whenever something contradicts with the role we had to take on in order to survive our homes growing up. That anything that differs from how your family saw you is going to feel fraudulent because that role wasn't a preference, right? Like that role was survival. And so when you step outside of that, it registers as danger. And that comes up as fear, as a sense of uneasiness, as that thing that you're feeling in your body that you can't explain. And this is one of the big things that I'm talking about in Safe Within, about how so much of what's happening in our head is just trying to make sense of what it is that we're experiencing in our body. So there's this deep sense of unease that comes up the second that we step outside of the role that we had to play to be safe. You know, the body feels it first, and then the mind goes looking for a reason because the mind needs an explanation. And what it comes up with is, you know, like I'm a fraud. I'm an imposter. This isn't really who I am. But this is not information. That's just the story your mind wrote about a feeling in your body. So now let's look at the second pattern, this kid that basically was told that they were perfect and the best at everything and that everything should come to them with ease. What I see being described here is the golden child in a narcissistic family. So this is the child who's told that they are, you know, superior in every single way, and they are praised constantly and indiscriminately for everything, like whether or not it's true. You are just seen as perfect in your parents' eyes. And that right there is not a parent seeing a child. That is a parent looking at a child and seeing themselves. Because when you're the golden child of a narcissistic family, this is a role that really has nothing to do with you. It is a job. Like you are there to reflect well on that parent. Your talents are their talents. Your report card is their report card. Your wins get told at the dinner party as a story about the amazing parent that they are. You know, when you're perfect, they get to be perfect. That is the arrangement. And so that's why the praise never actually lands. And it's not just that you got praised too much and it lost its meaning. It's that on some level, you know that the praise was never really about you. And so when you do something good, there's this sense underneath it that's just like, this isn't mine. And it doesn't matter how objectively real your accomplishments are, because the accomplishment was never being measured on its own terms in the first place. It was always being harvested for their benefit. And so this is like a really specific kind of fraudulence that comes from this. It's like that these accomplishments that you can't ever feel because they were always occurring in service of somebody else's image the whole time. The win always went back to the parent. And on top of that is also what comes with when you do fail. Because in this one, like struggling means that you stop being useful. Like your job is to be perfect. And if you're not perfect anymore, then who are you exactly to them? And so that's why like encountering struggle, difficulty, things not coming to you with just ease, why that can feel so catastrophic. And it's not just that it contradicts with what you were told about yourself. It's that it threatens the only role that you've ever had. And there's a real danger in that when it comes to having a narcissistic parent, because when you stop being the mirror for them, they don't just get disappointed. Like there are real consequences. There's rage, there's contempt, there's withdrawal where you can go from being the favorite to being nothing overnight. And so this isn't about a kid that's just worried about a bad grade. This is a kid whose entire safety in that house is contingent on them being the thing that makes their parent feel good about themselves and look good. And when you can't do that anymore, like the protection goes with that. And so you carry this into adulthood and you're 40 years old and you know, you're about to try something that you might not be good at, and your whole system floods with this dread that is completely out of proportion with whatever it is that you're working on, right? Like this, an emotional flashback, because it's not about whatever it is that's in front of you, whatever it is that you're about to do. It is the part of you that's still 9 years old and knows what happens when you're not perfect at something. It really becomes a matter of safety and survival. But now I want to contrast this with like the more traditional sense of the golden child that's not a reflection of a narcissistic parent, but that this was the role that you played to hold the family together, of keeping yourself safe, being the one who got good grades, who was good at sports, who stayed out of trouble, who didn't cause any problems, you know, who helped the family look good from the outside. And all of that can be completely true about who you are. You know, you can be genuinely smart and accomplished and capable. But underneath this, there is a part of us that knows that this is a role, that knows that this is rooted in the false self that we had to construct in order to be loved, to be accepted, to be safe. And so that's where this fraud feeling comes from. It's not that like you think that you're stupid or incapable. There's just this, not a conscious knowing, but a knowing within us that I'm playing a role right now. You know, there's some part of us that clocks that this is a performance in some way, like that this is us being who we need to be. And so this shows up more as like a feeling than a thought. It's just like sort of this quiet hum sense that this is a lie, that this is all sort of rooted in who you think that you need to be in order to survive, in order to be loved, in order to be accepted. It's something that we can't necessarily name, but it's something that we deeply feel. So up until this point, we've been talking about imposter syndrome as it relates to intelligence and achievement. But now I want to discuss a version of this that is much deeper, that is a lot more insidious. And I think a lot of us with complex PTSD are living in this. It is this imposter syndrome about your right to exist, your right to take up space at all. Imposter syndrome that is really rooted in toxic shame, in this belief that there is something inherently flawed about us. There is something pathologically wrong with us, that underneath it all, at our very core, like we are defective. And I talked about this last week in my episode on emotional flashbacks, when I talked about what happened to me once I became the identified patient in my family. you know, this belief got installed in me that it wasn't that I was stupid or that I was incapable. It was that there was something at my very core that was so fundamentally wrong with me that it cancels out everything good about me, that it doesn't matter what I accomplish, it doesn't matter what anybody says about me, that at my core, there is something so fundamentally fucked up about me. And this version of imposter syndrome can show up in so many areas of our lives and is really based in this distorted perception of ourselves, our inability to see the reality of who we are. And so I said at the top of the episode that part of me doing this episode was me confronting my own imposter syndrome. So let me explain what I meant by that. So this is the first time in 5 years that I have ever done 2 solo episodes back to back. Because every single time I sit down to do a solo episode, the same thing comes up. And it has nothing to do with the content. It's one question. It's, why would anyone want to listen to me for an hour or however long it is? You know, like, why would someone want to listen to just me? What do I have to offer that would justify somebody giving me a full episode? And so this is something that I've been carrying all along. And I want to tell you a story that I haven't told in a long time. So this was between Brian number one and Brian number two. And at this point, I had started to figure out that my problems in dating were connected to my childhood, but I still did not understand the gravity of what I was actually dealing with. Like, at this point, my thinking was, okay, I'm an adult child. I'll take a year off from dating. And I've read this book and surely that will do it, right? Surely that'll be enough. Well, we know how that played out, right? Enter Brian number two. But during this period of time, I ended up going to this meditation retreat in Georgia. It was this place. It was called the Delphi. I think it's Delphi University. It's in the woods on the Tennessee-Georgia border. And it's this place that offers all these like woo-woo bachelor's and master's and spiritual shit that you can't get a degree anywhere else in. But they also do, like, you know, weekend retreats. And so I was up there doing this retreat. It was called Inner Sanctuary Training. It was teaching you this meditation technique. And so while I was up there, I got a life path reading from one of the intuitives who was instructing the course. And at the time, I was not really jazzed about what she had to say. You know, a lot of it didn't make any sense to me. And the stuff that, you know, did make sense or that I did understand, well, it was like stuff that I was not particularly like excited about. Like, she was telling me that my life purpose this time around was spiritual. And I just remember thinking like, wow, that sounds like so fucking lame. Like, that sounds so damn boring. And so then I just like filed it away and I didn't really think much about it. And then enter Brian number two, right? And I really bottomed out with all this stuff. And, you know, part of hitting that bottom was the realization that I had never considered what a fulfilling career would look like. I'd never really thought about the question of like, what am I here to do? You know, like, what is my actual calling? And so, you know, I embarked on this journey. And so then, you know, somewhere in there, it was probably about 2 years after I had had that reading, I went back and listened to the recording again. And it was mind-blowing because there was stuff on there that I did not remember her saying at all. It was stuff that meant absolutely nothing to me at the time that I got the reading that landed completely differently when I was now listening to this, you know, 2 years later. And the part that really stood out to me was she was talking about how my gift is communication and that I have a way of saying things in a way that people can actually receive it, which at that point, I was starting to really notice this about myself. You know, I was having these interactions with mostly strangers where I'd see that I'd had the ability to say something and watch it land for someone in a way that kind of surprised me. Like I was starting to realize that like exactly what she said, I have a way of saying things in a way that people can actually receive it. And here's the thing, like I 1000% know this about myself. Like, I know that this is one of my superpowers. It is the way that I talk. It is the way that I speak from my own experience. I think I have an ability to say like a harsh truth or something that might be painful for somebody to hear or acknowledge about themselves. And I think I have an ability to say it in a way where they can actually take it in instead of getting defensive. And listen, I know that I'm not for everybody, right? We already know this and I'm okay with that. But like for the people that I am for, I do. I have an ability of communicating in a way in which you can take it in. And I think another part of it too is like my ability to add in humor. I think that I have a real gift of being able to bring in sarcasm and jokes without taking away from how serious the thing is that we're talking about, and being able to like poke fun at myself without it turning into like tearing myself down. You know, I've described it before as like self-empowering self-deprecation, you know, so I call myself a motivational roaster. And so here I am with this belief that shows up anytime I sit down to do a solo episode that's like, why would anyone want to listen to me for an hour? You know, it's like me feeling like a fraud for taking up an hour, for doing a solo episode. Like, I'm not qualified for this. Like, I don't have the right to take that space. Like, if I sit down and do this, I'm pretending to be somebody that I'm not. When the reality is, this is exactly opposite from the truth. This couldn't be further from the truth. Like, this is actually fundamentally who I am. The way that I communicate is my gift. And yet, still there it is. This feeling that I sit down every time that I want to record. And then let's take this a step further. Another way that this has shown up for me, and I talked about this when I first announced my course, Safe Within, that there was a whole lot of imposter syndrome that I had to work through, you know, just to make this thing exist, to announce it, to get this thing going. For the past 2 years, my therapist has been asking me the same question. Why aren't you doing courses? Why aren't you working with people one-on-one? And like, she's not just like asking it gently, like she keeps bringing it back up. And I have such great respect for her. And I also know that like, she wouldn't be asking me this question unless she like really thought that this is something that I should be doing. But every time it's like the same thing comes up. I'm not qualified. Like, who the hell am I to do this? I'm still such a shit show myself. Why would anyone want to work through their stuff with me? You know, like sort of the same sort of my right to take up space. And so again, let's connect that back to that reading that I got from that intuitive again. So when I listened to it the third time, I think the podcast had already started. I had already started the community. And there was another piece in there that I hadn't noticed, you know, the first or the second time. And she was telling me about how she really could see me running my own recovery groups, that like having my own community, having my own way of doing it, that I can really bring something to the healing space that is uniquely mine and very much needed. And so like the real breakthrough moment for me that finally allowed me to like, all right, let's do the damn thing when it comes to this course, was like really sitting with the truth of the matter that there is something about me that makes people feel really safe, you know, and this is also part of my origin story of this podcast. It was largely these interactions that I had with strangers, and it was two things that I noticed about myself. One was, you know, the way that I communicate lands with people, that they can actually take it in. And the other one was that people open up to me, like that there is something about me that makes them feel safe enough to say the thing out loud. It's my energy, it's the way that I show up. I think it's my vulnerability, my authenticity, and a genuine curiosity with people. Like, it's not manipulative in any sort of way. It's just truly who I am. Like, the number of times that I've sat with a total stranger and have them tell me, you know, 20 minutes in, that they're telling me something they've never said out loud before, or that they're like shocked that they're telling me this because they just met me. And you guys hear it on the podcast every damn week, right? Like, these are seasoned therapists and practitioners, you know, people with 20 or 30 years of experience, you know, and how they will stop mid-sentence and be like a little bit stunned at what they're sharing with me so soon. And so again, I'm not everyone's cup of tea, but there is something about me that makes people feel safe. And this is the most crucial element of healing there is. Like, nothing happens without it. You can have the best framework in the world. You can be the most educated. You can have the best information, the best techniques. And none of that matters at all if the person doesn't feel safe enough to actually go there. And so, you know, when it came to creating Safe Within, and I'm sitting there feeling like I'm not qualified, who am I to do this? The fact of the matter is that I am exactly the person who should be doing something like this. And honestly, the proof is in the pudding. I've been blown away by how this thing is going. It really is turning into something special, and I'm excited to run it again once this ends. So stay tuned. And so there's one more piece of this that I'm still working on, which is working with people one-on-one. Now, I'm already doing it, you know, like quietly, I've been doing it. But there is something about saying it out loud here on the podcast, or saying that in my introduction, like when I am announcing the shit show, to like also announce that I work with people one-on-one. There's something about it that feels embarrassing to say that out loud, which again, this is not rooted in any sort of reality. Like, there's no version of that that holds up if you actually look at it. So that's the last piece that I am working through it. So stay tuned. More announcements will be coming on that soon. But this is the whole thing, isn't it? Right? Like, doesn't have to make sense in your life. Again, it's this imposter syndrome, this feeling like you're a fraud, that's just like really rooted in this belief that there is something fundamentally wrong with you. And it is sneaky, sneaky, sneaky. But the thing here that really shows up with this toxic shame imposter syndrome is like the avoidance piece, you know, because with this brand of imposter syndrome, it's like we don't do the thing, you know, like that's the outcome. Not that we like do them badly, not that we do them and feel bad afterwards. We just don't do it. And I think that the reason is this, or at least this is what I've come to learn about myself, because it's like, what if I do the thing and the thing that I'm already convinced is going to happen actually happens? Like, what if that confirms it? So what if I announce the course and nobody signs up? And now it's not just a belief anymore. Now I have proof. Now the thing that I believed about myself, which is why would anyone want to take a course with me? This belief that is deep, deep down inside of me has now been further affirmed. I have evidence that supports that. So it's so much easier to just put it off, to not do it at all. Because if I don't do it, then it can't get confirmed, right? The belief stays where it is and it doesn't get any worse. And I think that's so much of where the procrastination lives. It's where the avoidance lives. That's where the freeze shows up. And it doesn't look like freeze. It looks like a to-do list that never moves. It looks like a project that you've been talking about for 4 years. It looks like, you know, waiting until you feel ready. What's so brutal about it is that it works, right? Like, that's why we keep doing it. You never get the confirmation, so it feels like you protected yourself. Except the not doing it becomes its own proof, because now years have gone by and you look back and there's a pile of things you never launched or never applied for or never announced. And your brain doesn't file that as "I was scared." It files it as, "See, I never do anything. You know, like, what's wrong with me?" So the thing you did to keep the belief from getting confirmed ends up confirming anyway. It just comes from a different direction. So another way this toxic shame imposter syndrome shows up is that you feel like a fraud when it comes to your own childhood trauma. Like, you feel like a fraud when it comes to your upbringing. You tell yourself other people had it worse, that it wasn't that bad, that you weren't damaged enough to call it what it actually was, that you're making a bigger deal out of this than it actually was. And so you feel like a fraud in therapy for taking up space in your own healing. Like, somebody's going to find out that you didn't have it that bad and you don't belong here. But what's happening here isn't just that you're doubting your pain, you're also doubting your worthiness of care. Because accepting your trauma means accepting that you deserve support, that you deserve therapy, that you deserve compassion and kindness. And when you are raised to believe that you're not worthy of any of those things, accepting that almost feels selfish, like you're asking for something you don't deserve. And here we have your trauma literally preventing you from acknowledging your own trauma. Like, the minimization is the trauma response. Accepting what happened to you is the very thing that would help you heal, but it's also the exact thing the wound will not let you do. The wound does not think that you deserve. All right, shit shows, do you ever have those days where everything takes you 3 times longer than you thought it would? I'll be honest, I have those days multiple times a week. And so then 6 p.m. rolls around and I've checked off like half my to-do list, and going to the grocery store is one of those things I've yet to do. Now, this is usually the moment that my inner critic loves to come in to start shaming me about how irresponsible I am, how I can't get it together, what the hell's wrong with me. But then I remember I have Omaha steaks in the freezer, and the critic no longer has a dinner crisis to shame me over. Now, having Omaha steaks in the freezer is like having a trusted butcher in a gourmet food shop right in my house. And let's talk about the flavor of these steaks, okay? Because when I buy steak at the grocery store, unless I marinate them ahead of time, it usually comes out kind of flavorless. But with Omaha steaks, I don't have to do a damn thing. No marinating, no planning, no thinking ahead. It is flavorful all on its own. And there's also a nostalgic thing going on for me, because my grandma, my dad's mom, she always gave us Omaha steaks every Christmas. And she was one of the few people that I felt truly unconditionally loved by. So there is a warmth to this that goes beyond just the way that they taste. Omaha Steaks has been around for over 100 years. It is the same damn beef people have trusted in their kitchen for generations, shipped nationwide straight to your damn door, arriving frozen, ready for grilling, searing, and roasting with minimal time and effort. I personally like to cook my steaks in the air fryer. So traditionally I've been a ribeye gal, but let me tell you about what I most recently got. The Burger Perfection Flight. For just $79.99, you get 20 premium steak burgers crafted from 5 distinct cuts of steak. So you can try the Burger Perfection Flight at Omaha Steaks today. That's 20 premium steak burgers for just $79.99. Plus, get 35% off with promo code BEEF. So that's omahasteaks.com, promo code BEEF for 35% off at checkout. Terms apply. See site for details. All right, so now let's talk about another form of imposter syndrome. And again, this is a deeper and more insidious version of imposter syndrome than this mainstream version that so many are familiar with. This is another one that I struggle with personally myself, that shows up also around doing solo episodes, but honestly, it shows up everywhere in my business, in my finances, in adulting in general. And this is one that so many of y'all are going to resonate with too. And this is imposter syndrome that is rooted in parentification. And the simplest way that I can sum this up is you feel like an imposter because you feel like a kid trapped in an adult's body. And the way that this shows up, the way that I've noticed this show up for me and what I've heard others experience, is that this shows up like a panic. It is like a sense of learned helplessness. It is just this place of, I can't do this. Like, I can't do this. I don't know how to do this. Like, this is too much. Like, somebody else needs to handle this for me. And so this comes up for me with the podcast episodes. It comes up like in other parts of my work. You know, it comes up with just like regular adult shit, insurance, car stuff, all of it. It is just this pervasive sense of, I don't know what I'm doing and I can't do this. And so when I sit down to do an episode, that's exactly what it sounds like. This is going to be hard. I'm going to struggle with this. I'm not going to be able to do it. And what it's actually rooted in is this kid who was handed responsibilities that were never hers to carry. A kid who was made responsible for keeping alive the person who was supposed to keep me alive, right? Who was managing a household at 9 years old and trying to keep everybody alive so that I could stay alive. So now here I am, and it feels like I'm this 7-year-old trapped in this 37-year-old's body going, I don't know how to run a podcast. You know, like, I don't know how to do social media. I don't know how to figure out my car insurance. Like, I don't know how to do any of this. And it's like, of course you don't, because you're 7 years old. You know, you're 7 years old. And I just think that so much of this imposter syndrome we're feeling is really coming down to the parts of us that have no idea how old we actually are, that haven't been updated. You know, as far as they know, it's still then. And so every time something comes up, it is about reminding this part of me that this isn't your job. Like, you don't have to run a podcast. You don't have to run a recovery community. You get to be a kid. And if you're not ready to go and do that, that's okay too. You know, you can stay here, right here with me. You know, you can be a part of this, but can you just give me a little bit of space so you can see that I can handle this? Like, so you can see that this doesn't have to be on you anymore, because I know that you've never been able to trust an adult to do what they said that they were going to do. Not one. So I understand why it's going to take you some time before you actually believe me. But could you just give me a tiny bit of room so that I can show you, so that I can actually prove it to you? And so that's it. That's this whole thing. You are 40 years old and you're walking around with this like felt sense that you are a child who has somehow been handled all of this, and that at some point someone's going to come along and notice that you're actually a kid. And I want to be clear about how this is different from what we just talked about, because this one really isn't about being defective. You know, this really doesn't have much to do with being flawed or being unworthy. This one is about capability. It's the sense that you are not developmentally big enough for the thing that's in front of you, that it is too much, that it is too big for you. And, you know, I think one part that makes this so confusing is that, like, when you were a kid, you were handling stuff that was way too big for you. You know, you were managing a parent, you were the emotional caretaker, or you were raising your siblings, or you were the one who was holding the whole house together. You know, you were doing adult things at 9 years old. So you think that you'd actually feel more capable, not less. You know, but that's not how this works, because the other component of this is that you never actually got to be a kid, which means you never got to be a beginner, and you never got to be bad at something with no consequences. You never got that part of childhood where you were safely incompetent and somebody bigger than you had it handled. You skipped completely over that. You went straight to being responsible for outcomes that you had no business being responsible for. And so now, as an adult, being new at something doesn't feel like being new. It feels like being in danger. And so again, it's getting these parts to trust us, to let them know that they no longer have to carry the weight of the world, all of this adult responsibility on their shoulders, and that they can just be a kid, right? Like, that we are going to handle all of this adult shit. And so the final piece that I want to touch on here are just a couple additional places where imposter syndrome shows up specifically for those of us with complex PTSD. So one of those is parenting. So where you're standing in your own kitchen with your own kid going, you know, I have no idea what I'm doing. You know, who let me do this? Somebody's going to figure out that I have no idea what I'm doing. It comes up in relationships when you're with somebody and there is this low hum of just waiting, of waiting for them to figure you out, because you feel like you've been showing them a version of yourself and the real one is underneath somewhere, and one day they're going to get a look at you and go, oh, like, this is not what I signed up for. And then I want to talk about a very specific version of this, because somebody I care about a great deal is going through this. This has come up for her recently. And so she's been with her husband since she was a teenager. You know, that's who she's been with basically her whole adult life. Well, yeah, her whole adult life, not basically, who she's been with her whole adult life. And when they got together, you know, she did not tell him about her trauma. Like, she did not disclose any of that. And so now all these years later, she's in it. Like, she is confronting some really intense stuff. And what's come up for her is this belief that she's a fraud, that she conned him, that she tricked him into marrying somebody she isn't, And now the real thing is showing up, and this is who he stuck with. And I want to say something about that because I think that this one is so cruel. You know, she didn't withhold anything. She couldn't have. She was a teenager, and she did not have access to it. And that's what this stuff does. It stays out of reach until you're stable enough or supported enough or far enough away from it for it to come up. And that's not a choice that you make. This is a protective mechanism doing its job. So what she's actually doing is taking a teenager who did not have the information, and she's putting her on trial for lying with evidence that this teenager wasn't allowed to see at that time. And the other piece of this is this idea that the person, you know, that he married was fake. She wasn't. This was her. That was the version of her that survival built. And she was real. And what's happening now isn't a switch. It's that the parts that were underwater are coming up. He's not getting a different person. He's getting more of the one he already has. But that is not how it feels from the inside, right? From the inside, it feels like the con is being exposed. And that's the thing about this brand of imposter syndrome. It will take 20 years of a real marriage and reread the whole thing as a lie. And I want to talk about the other side of this, which is how the person on the receiving end responds. Because sometimes what's happening isn't just in your head. Sometimes you're actually getting a response that confirms it, where your healing is being treated like an inconvenience, like a disruption to the whole schedule, where there's this unspoken expectation that you're going to handle this over here quietly on your own time and be done with this like in a reasonable amount of time. Like there's a deadline on it where you're allowed to be in it as long as it doesn't require anything from them. And I want to say something about that, because here's the thing, folks. Just because your trauma wasn't showing doesn't mean it wasn't there. And just because you weren't conscious of it doesn't mean it wasn't in the room the whole time. We are attracted to people for a reason. That's just how this works. Somebody who endured serious childhood trauma is not going to find themselves partnered up with a person who came from a completely healthy, well-regulated home. That's just not a thing, okay? That's not a thing. That's not how this works. This is not how any of this works. And so the idea that they signed up for someone without trauma and now you've changed the whole deal on them, nope. They chose you. And whatever was in you that made them feel at home was in you the whole time. It was operating in that relationship from day one on both sides. And so what would you actually expect from a partner here? Not that they fix it. Not that they know what to say, because most of them won't, right? But that they're willing to be in it with you. That when it comes up, you don't have to manage them on top of managing your own healing. That they can hear, this is what happened to me, without making it about how hard it is for them. That is the whole thing, willingness. And then there's the other piece of this, which can also be one of the hardest parts of healing. And I don't think we talk about this enough, that there are relationships that just don't survive you getting better. And I don't mean the obviously toxic ones. I mean the ones that on the surface like seemed fine, were fine. You know, maybe nobody was doing anything terrible. There wasn't abuse. From the outside, there's nothing to point at, but you change and you become somebody with more depth. Somebody who actually knows themselves, somebody who's living out of who they actually are instead of the role that you were handed. And intimacy starts meaning something completely different to you. What you need from another person starts meaning something completely different to you. And that relationship can't meet you there, not because it's bad, but because it was built by a version of you that just no longer exists anymore. And so that's the other thing nobody tells you about with this work. It's like, you know, you don't just lose the parts of yourself you were ready to let go of. Sometimes you lose relationships that were built around those parts. And it's not because anybody did anything wrong. It's just that it's no longer a fit. And so how do we heal all of this, folks? And I'm going to say the same thing that I said last week in the emotional flashback episode, that we could be here for hours talking about this. There are so many modalities. What works is going to be different for everybody. And all I can do is share what's worked for me. And for me, it has been somatic work, actually learning how to feel safe in my own body. You know, I shared in a shit show group this past Sunday, the topic was uncertainty, you know, about how so much of our lives get dictated by external uncertainty. So what's going to happen? You know, what does this person think of me? Like, where is this going? And I feel so free from all of that now. Like, I truly do. You know, but what I've come to know over the past 2 years is that there is just this uncertainty, just this fear that exists, that lives in my body. It's not necessarily attached to anything. It's just there. And so a lot of this work has just been about getting some of that out, you know, this stuck survival energy that has been living in me this whole time, getting some of that to move, but I can't get rid of all of it, right? And that's not the goal. And I want to be honest about that. So the rest of it is learning how to be with it, learning how to meet it, learning how to actually feel those sensations in my body without immediately going into some form of numbing out. And then the other piece is parts work, really learning about these parts of me, what they actually think they're doing, what their job is, what they are terrified is going to happen if they stop doing it, and what wounded exile underneath they're standing in front of. And I've said this before, but we think we really do know why we do certain things. We think that we know why a part is doing what it's doing, but we're coming at from a place of adult logic. Like, we forget that these parts of us were formed when we were very, very young. And what they're actually doing is not necessarily available to us from up here in our adult brain. Like, you cannot think your way to it. The only way that you can find out is by actually connecting with them, by getting them to open up to you. And this has been an extremely slow process for me, but it has been an extremely effective process for me. And the last thing that I just want to say is that I really enjoyed putting this episode together. And that feeling of, why would anyone want to listen to me? It is not here. It has not been in the room with us the whole time, folks. It ain't here. Why wouldn't you want to listen to me, right? Why the hell wouldn't you want to listen to me? I'm a really fucking good communicator. I know how to say this shit in a way in which you can actually take it in. And I think I am pretty damn entertaining while doing it. And so for those of you who are crippled with self-doubt and imposter syndrome, please hear the hope from me on this. It's possible. And that is all. Thank you. Love you all. Let it all go.